Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Jefferson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. This morning, the first case for oral argument is Gaken and Eagle Tail, plaintiffs and appellants versus the City of Rapid City, defendant and appellee. For the appellants is Mr. Robin Zephyr, an attorney from Rapid City, and for the appellee is Mr. Michael Boer, who I understand will be presenting the argument, and note the also the presence of Jason Green, the city attorney. With that, Mr. Zephyr, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Justices. May it please the Court, gentlemen. Again, it is both an honor and a privilege to again appear before this honorable court. This is a case that is of extreme importance. I think that one of the reasons why we are here before you today is that it is a case of first impression, not only on the facts, but also on the issue of law that is applied in this situation. I understand that we are dealing with a case which is of a nature involving a sensitive issue in the sense that as human beings, we have before us a responsibility to lead our lives in a just and good manner. When parents of this nature, as my clients, Maria Gaken and Fred Eagletail, agreed to bring children into the world and start a family through the background of their Lakota culture as well as their Christianity, they tried to do the best that they could in bringing those children forth and recognized fully that life is precious, no matter who we are, where we come from, how small, how large, but so is death. And part of the information that was briefed, Justices, was to try to shed some light on one of the issues that was brought forth at the trial court as well, and the reason why the issue, from our perspective, is of a sensitive nature and therefore formulates a matter of first impression under the considerations of SDCL 3-21-2 and 3, which is the 180-day notice provision concerning municipal liability. I am not sure exactly what questions I could answer for the justices here today.
Maybe you could start with, did the judge grant a summary judgment in this case?
Yes, he did, Justice Cohen.
Now, I see in the briefs that he entered findings of fact also, is that right?
That's correct.
Now, I haven't seen that before. Why would a judge enter findings of fact in a summary judgment case?
Well, Your Honor, I think, again, Judge Delaney listened to this case and he was very, very accommodating. I think the city attorneys would agree that we spent a large amount of time on this case, both in the motions hearing, there were two of them, as well as in the opportunity to gather together legal analysis and briefing. And it was somewhat of a unique scenario because we not only were dealing with the motion to dismiss, which had been on file since October 2001, but never heard, but we were also dealing with the motion for summary judgment, particularly on the issues of the civil rights complaints or claims and whether or not that possibly could trump the status of the 180-day notice provision. So I think what Judge Delaney was doing when he basically ordered the sides to present, both sides were ordered to present their versions of the fact, findings of fact and conclusions of law, was that he wanted to clearly articulate for a reviewing court what his findings were. I think that in that sense it was somewhat different, but I think that he was just trying to clarify, knowing fully well that this case was going to be heard before the Supreme Court. In fact, Judge Delaney, on several occasions during the hearing, clearly enunciated his sympathetic feelings and encouraged my clients to appeal to this court because of the nature of the question.
If?
Yes, Justice.
I don't want to interrupt you. Following up on that question, as far as the findings of fact, if there are, normally if there are disputes and there has to be findings of fact, it would get past a summary judgment motion and would actually go to a jury. Can you address, if this were to happen here, what would, if we were to send it back and say, no, the jury needs to decide these findings or these facts, that these are in dispute, can you kind of explain to me what then the jury might be determining and what might be findings of fact here or dispute in the facts that would get past a summary judgment and be presented to the jury?
I'll try, Justice. Yes, that was one of our basic arguments at the trial court level, was in fact it should not be decided on a motion for summary judgment, because not only were we dealing with dispute of fact as to actually what happened in the events themselves, but we were also dealing with a question of fact as to whether or not there was fraud or concealment, which would entirely take the matter out of the realm of SDCL 3-21-2. The reason that that was so important was because there was a factual dispute as to what the knowledge was at the time between Ty Eagletail's funeral, which was October 15th of 1999, up until 180 days passed, and furthermore, beyond that, to the two-year period in which he had to bring suit. In that respect, there were acts done and conduct that was noticed and alleged on behalf of the city employees, which were the individuals Tom Vallette and Jerry Zimmerman. Mr. Vallette was the supervisor of the cemetery and had direct supervision over Mr. Zimmerman. These individuals were two employees out of at least three employees at the city cemetery. The other employee was Kay Bresch. But in that regard, I believe that yes, most definitely there were dispute in fact. I think in my brief I noted that I had presented on behalf of the plaintiffs and the appellants our version of what we believe the findings of fact should have been, and the court rejected our version, of course, but he did in fact encourage us to present that, which in my mind clearly established that there, what the judge was doing basically was trying to create a record in which a reviewing court could have a chance to look at and make determinations. We do not concede that there were no disputes in general or disputes in material fact enough that a jury should decide not only the underlying facts of the claims in this case, but also on the notice issue, especially the concealment.
Two questions.
Yes, Justice Sager.
First of all, you know, and I don't want a version, I want, what physical evidence do you have to show this court as to the record, what physical evidence do you have in the record that they actually buried the child in the wrong place?
Well, physical evidence you're talking about?
Yes. Well, or any other kind of evidence. What evidence do you have that they buried the child in the wrong place?
Well, number one is there was actually an exhumation that took place, which is also known as a disinterment, basically digging Ty's grave up again. And that was done on May 9th of 2002. There was a particular process to go through with that. You had to obtain a legal disinterment permit, and that was obtained through Mr. Kirk from the funeral home. He got the necessary signatures, and that was legally done, and it was filed with the clerk. Through that process, unfortunately, the parents were put through that episode of having to see their son dug up. When he was extracted from the grave, which was the grave nearest the tree from the photographs, which was essentially grave number one, which is noted in the Exhibit 24, the deposition of Kay Bresch. He was dug up from grave number one. There were witnesses present, there were photographs taken, video, measurements done. Mr. Kirk was present himself. Mr. Kirk was important in this case because he not only was there at the time of the body preparation prior to the first funeral, but he was there at the funeral.
Well, just a minute. When your people were out there for the funeral, wasn't there just one open grave there at the time, and that was next to the tree?
Actually, this is what led to the confusion, was the infant graves at the Mountain View Cemetery, and I suspect maybe anywhere else in any other cemetery, are relatively small. I think they're only 3x5, the plots. Therefore, the graves themselves are probably only maybe 2 to 2.5 feet apart from foot to head. At the time of the funeral, what we believe, and what we believe we can prove now, is that Ty was laid in a grave in lot number 13, which was approximately 1.5 to 2 feet east of grave number one, which is grave number one was closest to the tree.
So what are you claiming, that the grave number one was open at the time of the funeral? And then after the funeral, when everybody left, they dug another hole and put Ty into that?
Vice versa, Justice. What we're claiming here is that at the time of the funeral on October 15th, 1999, that Ty Eagletail was placed in grave number 13. And then sometime later, we're not sure because it's never been admitted, but sometime later, somebody dug that grave up, grave 13, took his body out, grabbed his little casket, turned it around, and had dug up another grave site in grave number one, and that's where he was placed.
All right, let's assume for the record that that is true, and in which case you'd have a genuine issue of fact. But still, how do you get over that in relation to every tort claim that you've got here, how do you get over the fact that 180 days went by and you gave no notice to the city of any tort claim?
Okay. Well, obviously, that's why we're here, but Justice Sabers, when...
I know, but you're the appellant, so you have to show where the trial court erred. So where did the trial court err?
We believe the trial court erred in not looking seriously at the concealment issue and the fraud issue to actually carve out an exception to the harsh application of the 180-day notice provision. In that respect, I think it's very important to understand what my client's knowledge was. They only suspected that their son was moved. They suspected that. But we're not talking about an ordinary tort sense against the tort case against a municipality.
Does the statute make any difference between an ordinary tort and some other kind of tort as far as notice is concerned?
No, it doesn't.
It includes all torts,
doesn't it? I believe so.
All right.
Contract, I don't believe, is included in that statute.
Okay, but that's the second issue.
Yes.
Okay, so how do you get by the 180-day notice? You just 180 days went by.
Well, because of the nature of the facts in this case, where we have a young child buried in a grave under 4 feet of earth, This is what I'm saying is it's different than the ordinary tort case because we have the sensibilities of death. We have the sensibilities of placing a person at peace.
I know, but you have just conceded that the 180-day notice applies to all tort claims, whether they're ordinary or unordinary.
I believe that that's true. But in a sense, Justice Sabers, that there was an inability of this grieving family to be able to know that their son had been moved, especially in the face of what the city officials were telling them. The city officials were flatly denying that they did anything wrong here, that they moved him at all. In fact, Tom Vallette, the supervisor of the cemetery, even went as far as to order his employee, Kay Bresch, to doctor the records, the official logbook, to change Ty's entry into the grave from grave 13 to grave 1. And I'm going to direct the justices to Exhibit 24, which is attached to the settled record on the deposition of Kay Bresch. That's where the official lot book is. So not only did the city officials attempt to alter official records, but they did so with an intent to conceal, intent to deceive, misrepresent, and I think you can also go along and assume that as a result of that conduct, they were hoping that Ms. Gaken and Mr. Eagletail would never do anything about it.
But Mr. Zephyr, as I read this, it appeared to me that your clients did not believe Mr. Vallette and did not believe the city officials, and that they did not believe the city officials from just within a few days of the burial. Is that correct?
That is partially correct, Justice Center.
So aren't they charged at that point with some duty to do something within the 180 days when they don't believe what the city's telling them?
I agree that certainly they should not just sit back and do nothing. I agree with that. However, this is where, again, I refer back to the unique status of what this case involves. These folks just lost a very special baby. This baby, when he was born with a terminal condition, anencephalia, which means that he was born without a brain, just a brainstem. And infants that are born with this condition normally only survive hours, if that. Ty was an extreme medical exception, and that's why there was a focus by the medical personnel to marvel at his condition, because he survived 2.5 months following his birth. So when the suspicions arose shortly after his funeral, when my client looked at a series of photographs, which were not all the photographs, but a series of photographs, it just didn't feel right to her. And she did not believe that it was right. And so she had this suspicion in her mind that was her son the victim of grave robbing? Did somebody actually carry out a nefarious scheme of attempting to dig his body up to take him for a medical study? Those were the kind of things that were running through these folks' minds during this period of time. They were dealing with the death process, they were dealing with the grieving process, and this was something that they could not go out and readily recognize, like looking at the damage to a 92 Ford or whatever you may have. This is why, Justice, we are calling for a further examination of what was going on in the totality of the circumstances to overcome the harsh application of the 180-day rule here, especially on the fraud and concealment issue.
Is there an issue, too, on when it was actually discovered? Does that come into play with this statute at all? In other words, that there was really no claim until the body was disinterred, and at that point, then there was more, enough evidence at that point.
Justice, you know, I believe that the courts are well aware that more and more so claimants and plaintiffs have to be careful in our world not to bring official claims or cases when they don't have information sturdy enough to back that up. You're subject to possible sanction. You're subject to Rule 11, barratry, whatever you may have. In this situation, my clients were not law trained. They had no knowledge of their legal rights. They had no clear concept of the 180-day rule. I believe fully what you're saying here is correct in that there was no true understanding of the accrual of it until the exhumation.
Could you carry that a step further then and say, you know, the language of the statute says that it has to be within, the notice has to be within 180 days after the injury. Could you carry that a step? Do you have any support in case law that you could call the injury at the time that they exhumed the body as the injury that you're suing for? The tort is based on the injury, which really the injury wasn't apparent until the body was exhumed, and so the 180 days would kick in after the after that time. Is there any case law that you've run into that could, that would give this court some basis to rule that way?
Justice Meyer-Henry, I wish there were. Again, I believe that's why this is a case of first impression on this issue in our state.
Your time has long expired. I'll let you answer the question. You get another 10 minutes.
Okay.
Later.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zafir. Okay, Mr. Boer, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. Judge Delaney's judgment dismissing the plaintiff's complaint in its entirety should be affirmed for two reasons. First, of course, the subject of counsel for plaintiff's argument was the 180-day notice rule. No notice was ever filed, and the statutory language of 321.2 is very clear. Second is the constitutional claims that were dismissed on a motion for summary judgment.
Wasn't there a breach of contract claim in there, too?
No, there wasn't. There wasn't, Chief Justice.
There's no breach of contract claim?
Absolutely not. Now, if you look at the complaint itself, there are basically five causes of action pled. They include negligence or reckless intentional conduct, violation of civil rights under 1983, negligent hiring, training, or supervision, fraud, deceit, concealment, and finally a claim for punitive damages. Not only that, there was no mention of this breach of contract claim anywhere in the trial court discussion and the motion for summary judgment.
Could you remind me in the evidence, how is it evident that someone would know that the city owned the site? I mean, normally you drive by and they're called some, what's this one called?
This is called Mountain View Cemetery.
Okay, and it has no indication from its title that it's city run or operated.
And that issue, of course, was brought up in this court's decision in Purdy v. Fleming, decided in 2002. And the issue there was a hospital. And in that case, the plaintiffs raised the argument that they didn't know this was a city facility. In this case, that argument's never been raised. The plaintiffs had never brought up the fact that they were unaware that the city owned the gravesite. But just as in Purdy v. Fleming, there is a city ordinance in play and on the books in the city of Rapid City, specifically the first part of Chapter 13, which declares both Mountain View and Calvary Cemetery to be city-owned cemeteries. So it's a declaration of the ordinance similar to in Purdy v. Fleming.
Is there anything in the, I mean, did they sign something when they originally buy the plot and, or the plot, and is there anything in that that indicates that it's city-owned?
I believe there is, Your Honor. There's a certificate of purchase when they buy the gravesite. And that goes directly to the city finance office.
Let me ask you about fiduciary duty. Doesn't the owner of a cemetery have a fiduciary duty to the families of deceased persons to exercise proper care and control over the bodies that are buried in that cemetery?
We don't believe so, Justice Incher. We believe certainly there's a contractual relationship there. Just as in many cases where someone is, bound by the contractual terms to take care of property in any way. There is definitely contractual terms that they're bound to. But there's a distinction between a fiduciary duty, such as found by this court in examples of physician-doctor, examples where there is this superior position of control.
Well, that's the point. When you commit a body to the cemetery, haven't the relatives essentially ceded that custody and control to the cemetery?
Well, they've certainly, pursuant to that contract.
I mean, the family has no opportunity to do anything with respect to the grave other than perhaps visit it and bring flowers and that type of thing. But they certainly can't dig. They can't do anything like that.
No, they certainly can't without permission, of course. But that's the point, is that, you know, as happened in May 9th of 2002, there was a consensual disinterment. And naturally, the cemetery works with the individuals to get that done. There are other examples in contractual relationships where the same set of facts applies. Naturally, we're dealing with cemeteries in a very sensitive nature here. But, for example, in the case of where someone rents space to store their property, for example, same set of facts in the sense that they are giving up right of control to store that there at that facility, but there's no fiduciary relationship simply because the owner of that property is controlling their property. The fiduciary relationship tests and where it's been found by this court are limited to some very specific situations where you have this attorney-client relationship, again, physician-patient, trustee, beneficiary, principal agent, partners, husband and wife. Those are all cases where the Supreme Court has found that fiduciary relationship. But the distinction here is that there is not this superior element of control or superior element of knowledge that is subject to and beholden to in this case. It's a contractual relationship, and certainly there are certain terms that the city is bound to, but it doesn't rise to the level of that fiduciary relationship. And on that point, the other consideration here is extremely important on the 180-day notice provision. Again, the statute makes very clear the 180-day notice needs to be provided to the governing body within 180 days of the date of injury. So it says date of injury, and as Purdy v. Fleming points out very clearly, the statute does not say date of discovery of injury, which is what plaintiffs are arguing for an extension of that doctrine.
Doesn't the trial judge or someone have to decide when they knew they were injured?
Yes, absolutely, and that was decided by the trial court based on three very plain points, and I'd like to go into that if I may.
Before you do that, did he make that decision in his findings of fact?
Yeah, the findings of fact, and again, the motion for summary judgment also had a motion for dismiss. The 180-day notice argument came on a motion to dismiss. So in the transcript.
So the decision to the decision saying that the statute had run was actually a motion, was an order to dismiss, not a summary judgment.
That came on a motion to dismiss, Your Honor. That's correct.
Was there, do courts ordinarily grant enter findings of fact and motions to dismiss? I haven't seen that either before.
That, in this case, was Judge Delaney's rationale. In the transcript, near the end of the hearing on the final day.
Ordinarily, as I understand the law, when you decide, when you're trying to decide what a person knew and when they knew it, that is a fact question for a jury or a trier of fact.
And again, to answer that question, I think what's imperative is to acknowledge the procedural posture here. In this case, we are assuming the allegations, as plaintiffs has alleged, to be true. We are assuming for purposes of this motion that the gravesite was in fact moved after the funeral in October 15th, 1999. That is why there's no dispute of fact in this case, because we're taking their allegations as true. In paragraph 15 of the complaint, they allege very specifically that the gravesite was moved within days of the funeral.
Well, I understand that's your position, but apparently the trial judge felt the need to enter findings of fact on when they knew. And I guess I'm concerned with why a trial judge would do that when it's a decision as a matter of law.
And I think that was done because, to clue you maybe a little to his rationale in the transcript, I asked, Your Honor, would the court like propose findings in an order? Judge Delaney responds that, well, you have problems. We're not giving summary judgment. I guess we're dismissing the claims, so those findings I would like to come in. Again, we had 2 days of hearings on this, or two separate days. And as counsel pointed out, there was a fairly lengthy transcript in this arena. I think Judge Delaney's rationale for providing the findings was to make sure that this court has a bearing on what facts were assumed to be true here. And that's the point. For the posture of this appeal, we are taking the facts and evidence in a light most favorable to that fact. Therefore, they're not in dispute. For the purpose of this appeal, they're not in dispute. We're assuming, as they've alleged, that the grave site was moved within days of the funeral. In Maria Gaken, plaintiff's deposition, which is quoted at length in the brief, she goes into very detail about how days after, when she was visiting the gravesite, she realizes it's not in the right spot. Her sister is with her, and ultimately her sister concludes the same way, that based on the positioning, it's not in the right spot. That shows you what her knowledge was, and it shows you that within days of the funeral, they knew the grave wasn't in the right spot. In the transcript for the hearing, this March 19th, the final day of the hearing, there's discussion about a phone call with the cemetery supervisor, Tom Vallette. And this happened, there's no certainty of when it happened, at the latest January of 2000, within months of the actual funeral. And the transcript shows how Ms. Gaken calls Mr. Vallette and accuses him of moving the gravesite, to which he denies wrongdoing, and she calls him a liar. You're a liar, she says. She doesn't believe him. Okay. That's imperative for the 180-day notice rule, because 180-day notice acts from the date of injury. Now, the date of injury, we know, based on taking the facts as alleged by the plaintiffs, occurred within days after the funeral, and the gravesite was moved. And in terms of extending a doctrine of fraudulent concealment in this matter, there's no reliance. Even if you grant an affirmative act that he denied wrongdoing, on months after the date of the funeral. We know that they didn't rely on that. And if you trace back the cases, and again, I would dispute the fact that this is a case of first impression. The statute on the 180-day notice rule, 321.2, is very clear. It's not ambiguous, and we have some very clear rulings from this court in that matter.
The defendant claims that his issue number two in both his appellant's brief and reply brief is that the defendants were not entitled to summary judgment on all state claims of negligence, reckless and intentional conduct, breach of implied and express contract, breach of fiduciary duty, intentional and negligent infliction of emotional distress, trespass, failure to adequately train, and so forth. Are you saying there's nothing whatsoever in the complaint and nothing was argued at the trial court about contract, breach of implied and express contract?
That's exactly what I'm saying, yes. If you review the complaint again, and I went through the five causes of action that are labeled and explicitly mentioned, there's no mention in there.
Was it not argued in these 2 days of hearing that you had? Contract was not argued?
That's correct, Your Honor. If you look through the transcript, there's no mention of a breach of contract. It wasn't brought up at the motion hearings. The transcript clearly reflects that.
There clearly was a contract here, wasn't there, between the plaintiffs and the city?
No question. Plaintiffs purchased the gravesite from the city. There was a contract. But there's no allegation of a breach of that agreement. And as this court is well aware, you can't bring up something on appeal that wasn't argued in the lower courts. Naturally, there's a plethora of case law on that point. You can't bring up something new now on appeal that wasn't argued at the circuit court level. And it simply wasn't. It wasn't pled. It wasn't argued. Simple as that.
Why wouldn't the fraudulent concealment be an issue for a jury to decide?
Simply because, really, it's a matter of law, Your Honor. Again, there's no dispute of fact here. We are assuming that the allegations are true, as plaintiffs have alleged, and plaintiffs themselves have indicated that they didn't rely on this.
Yeah, but they really wouldn't have known they thought that their son was not even buried in that particular place, isn't that right? I mean, they weren't quite sure what had happened until that body was exhumed. How would they have really known? I mean, they had suspicions, but they wouldn't have known for sure until that date.
I think even if you grant that they had an elevated level of certainty after this consensual disinterment, you still don't go around the fact that the standard here is not date of discovery of injury or date of certainty of injury. It is date of injury. And as plaintiff's own allegations reflect, the gravesite was moved within days after. That's when the injury occurred. We have her deposition testimony showing that she had that knowledge days after. And we have the complaint itself, which alleges it was moved within days after. And again, if the standard were date of discovery of injury, then I think that that's absolutely true, but it's not. Statute is clear, and this court's ruling in Purdy v. Fleming in 2002 is very clear. It's date of injury, not date discovery of injury. But turning back now to the fraudulent concealment argument, that argument works when you have an affirmative representation and you have reliance or inducing the other party to rely on that representation. We simply don't have that element of reliance here, and that's what's critical. That's the theme that flows through all the Supreme Court's precedent on this issue, is that if you don't have reliance on this alleged affirmative representation, you simply don't have fraudulent concealment. There's only one issue in the record that you can point to for a potential denial of wrongdoing, and that's this phone call that took place when once the funeral. We have her statements in the record when she refers to this phone call, in the motion hearing transcript itself, which calls him a liar. She doesn't believe him. That is not reliance on an affirmative representation. It's not even close to that. Based on that lack of reliance, fraudulent concealment falls. It just doesn't apply here. In the cases where this court has told the statute of limitations, there's three specific cases in a line of them that occur in 1995. In 1995, this court decided Smith v. Neville. And the following year, they decided Erickson. Excuse me, you decided Erickson. And in 1997, this court decided Myers v. Charles. In each of those three cases, the statute on notice of claim was told. They all involved motorist accidents. And in each of those cases, within 180 days, there was a writing, a submittal of a claim, some notice that the injury occurred and we are submitting a claim. Okay? In each of them. Now, granted, in each of them, it wasn't sufficient to be specific to the statute, but there was an affirmative representation within that six-month time frame that we have a claim here and we're going to pursue it. And there was also affirmative representation that the plaintiffs relied on that we're either investigating your claim or looking into it and we'll get back to you. And as this court said plainly, when you deceive them, or when they rely that you're looking into their claim, you can't just hide under the 180-day notice rule. But that doesn't apply here. If you look at the timeline of events, from the time of the funeral in May of 1999, May 15th, from the time when it was moved, and again, we're taking the allegations to be true, days after that, we have a phone call that took place. We have the plaintiff calling Mr. Vallette a liar, not believing him, not relying. And after that, we have a lot of time that passes. As the motion made clear, the plaintiffs came to see counsel in August of 2000. That's clear from the transcript. But from August of 2000 to when suit was filed in October of 2002, there's nothing. There's no notice to the city. There's no argument that there's notice to the city. You know, there was a meeting in September of 2002, apparently, and there was a letter to the cemetery from counsel in just before the suit was filed. But there's nothing to indicate in the record that notice was given anywhere near the 180-day date of injury in this case. I want to touch on the constitutional matter.
Tell me again, what was the date of that conversation with Mr. Vallette?
We don't know the exact date, but the record suggests that it was at the latest January of 2000, within months of the funeral. But
within 180 days or outside 180 days?
Certainly within it. The funeral took place on October 15th of 99, and as I understand it, at the latest, that conversation took place in January of 2000. So it was within the 180 days, but again.
And then when was the notice given from that telephone call?
There was no notice given. There hasn't been any notice given. And that's the point here, too, is that 321.6 suggests that in a jurisdictional matter.
When was the lawsuit started in relation to that phone call?
The lawsuit was filed in October of 2002. So, you know, you certainly cannot make the argument that that phone call, however, was enough to give claim, give notice of claim, excuse me. If you look at the Myers decision decided by this court in 97, they extend the doctrine of substantial compliance. They suggest that even though you don't submit verbatim notice of claim, we will allow it under certain circumstances.
You better get to your constitutional question.
Okay, I certainly do that. And I think the issue is pretty clear here. It's a 1983 action, and as this court is well aware, in 1978, the Monell decision, decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, extended the doctrine of constitutional liability to municipalities. But they clearly said, looking at the legislative history and the language of the statute, that it can't be based on respondeat superior liability. In other words, individual tortfeasors cannot hold the city liable. There has to be this pattern, or practice, or policy as the driving force behind the constitutional deprivation. The record makes very clear that there are no other incidents of misconduct or alleged wrongdoing at the cemetery. There simply was no notice provided to the city. There's no pattern, there's no practice, etc. I believe that's undisputed. I believe council has admitted that there has been no established record of problems at the cemetery. Now, it's based on that Judge Delaney's well-reasoned decision is there can be no basis for 1983 liability without this established pattern or practice. If there are no other questions, thank you very
much. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Zephyr, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Justice Meyer Henry, I wanted to get back to the question that you had posed before we quit last time. You had asked about the possibility of a creation of a new injury following the exhumation on May 9th of 2002. That has always been our position. As a result of the suspicions that this young family had over whether or not their son was even in the grave, when they did establish that he had been moved and his casket actually had been turned the opposite direction in contravention to Lakota and Christian culture, they immediately at that moment realized what had happened and became concerned as to whether or not Ty was in fact even in his casket. So what steps needed to be taken at that point was that he was taken to the funeral home, and in the presence of witnesses and Mr. Kirk, the casket was unsealed, and that their son was there. He was seen inside the casket. That's not a pleasant thing for any parent to undergo, but they did realize some peace of mind knowing that their son was not the victim of a grave robbery at that point. But that certainly is something that we press the court to consider, as those were extra facts and circumstances that, again, we think taken into the totality of the circumstances should overcome the harsh application of the 180-day rule.
So from that, then, how much time passed till the lawsuit was filed?
I apologize. I need to correct Mr. Boer. He said that the lawsuit was filed in October 2002. It was actually October 2001. So by the time the exhumation had occurred, the lawsuit had already been filed by approximately 9 months.
But you argue that the 180 days shouldn't run until the disinterment. I assume that's your legal position.
Yes.
But yet you had enough knowledge to file a lawsuit well before that.
Justice Zinter, the reason that the lawsuit was brought when it was there was a meeting that was held at the gravesite back on October 10th or 11th, 2001, shortly before the suit was brought. Mr. Kirk was present. The officials from the cemetery were present. City Attorney Tamara Peer was present. I was present. My client was present. And new photographs that were never seen before that came into the possession of my client were shown. And we were looking at the gravesite, and at that point there was an extreme extreme suspicion that Ty had been moved, and yet the cemetery personnel, even confronted with that status, still denied that he had been moved. But we were under a 2-year statute of limitations, which meant that you either file the suit at that time or you essentially lose your right to a remedy. So that's why the lawsuit was filed at that time. In fact, that was the first time that photographs that are contained in the addendum to my brief, the ones depicting my client standing next to her son's grave, were shown to these individuals, and those came into my client's possession shortly before that time.
Was it ever realized before the commencement of the lawsuit that the plaintiffs failed to give a 180-day notice?
Yes.
It was realized?
Yes.
But no attempt was made to correct it or to do anything about it in the sense of giving a notice?
The only thing that was done was there was a letter that I had sent to the city attorney back in September 2001, which basically triggered a more intensive concentration on the situation. And in that, we posed a series of questions based upon our suspicions to the city attorney, or through to the cemetery, but eventually ended up in the hands of the city attorney. What they did is that they responded through the city attorney by letter of October 9th of 2001, basically stating that they made a mistake. There was one hole dug. It was dug in the wrong place. And then a second hole was dug, and the first one was covered up. But this all occurred before Ty's funeral. And obviously, as facts came to bear after the exhumation, we knew that that was false.
Is all of what you just stated, is that in the record?
Yes, it is.
Right. Now, what do you have to say about the contract claim that they say wasn't even in the lawsuit, wasn't in the pleadings?
It is in the pleadings.
It's what?
It is in the pleadings.
Read it to me, will you?
Yes. It's contained in several paragraphs. There was a motion to amend the complaint, which was done back on November 18th of 2003. And the first amended complaint was filed in exhibit or paragraph 11. Let me find that page, Justice. Paragraph 11 refers to the agreement contract between the plaintiffs and the defendants. Paragraph 15 also refers to the contract between the standards and the contract between the parties. Paragraph 19 also refers to acts and omissions made by the defendants Valette and Zimmerman.
Acts of omissions are, that's tort once again. Yeah. Just stick to contract.
Paragraph 33 refers to contract. Paragraph 34 and paragraph 35.
All right. Read the best paragraph you got in there that says the city is being sued for breach of contract.
At all times relevant to the events described in this complaint, defendants owed a duty of care to Maria Gaken and Frederick Eagletail Jr. to properly and reasonably supervise their employees, to proper interment and otherwise bury and complete said interment without violating citizens' contract and personal rights.
Without violating what?
Citizens' contract and personal rights. I do admit that there is no specific reference to the word breach of contract as a separate phrase in the complaint, but contract is mentioned.
Well, was breach of contract argued, though, in the motion to dismiss and in the summary judgment hearing? Was that issue argued?
It was not argued with any sort of prominence. It was something that I believe everybody, including the judge, we were so focused on the 180-day situation and whether or not there was justification to overcome that harsh application that it was not focused on. And I agree with Mr. Boer that it was not a prominent issue at the motions hearing. It may have been discussed or mentioned, but there was never any focus upon it.
So you never said something to the judge like, well, no matter what happens on the 180-day notice, it doesn't apply to a contract claim, so therefore they're still stuck, or they still could have liability on the contract claim?
I don't want to misstate anything, Justice Sabers.
You don't remember stating that kind of an argument?
I don't, unless that was in a letter brief that I did shortly before the last hearing. That was made a part of the official record that was actually served as a legal brief before our second motions hearing. But as far as my oral enunciation of that principle, I don't have any recollection that it was talked about.
Is there anything in the findings of fact about breach of contract?
No, I don't believe there is.
All right. And so you didn't take any exceptions to the absence of those findings of fact either?
The absence of its mention?
You didn't take any objection to the absence of any findings of fact relating to breach of contract?
I don't believe I did specifically.
Okay.
Again, we'd like to thank the court for having us here and being able to share this information with you.
Thank you, Mr. Zephyr. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.